Okay. So hello there. Today I'm here with Christian Ferrand, who is the Lewis Thomas Professor of Surgery at Harvard Medical School, and one of the people I consider the optimal person to give us insight into how one travels through academic research and in a medical center. And Christian, it's great to be here with you today. I'd really want to hear from you about your ideas about mentoring, and I'd like to start out with a little bit about your background and history about how you achieved full professorship at Harvard and how that came to be in terms of your mentoring and guidance that you received throughout your career.
Thank you, Leo, for the invite, and thank you for all these compliments. I think I received as much as I gave to to my mentees. I learned from them as I think even more so than they learned from me. So I don't know how far back you want to go with my history. I'm a transplant nephrologist by training. I'm a nephrologist by training. I arrived here to do a 2 years of postdoctoral fellowship with Dr. Fritz Bach back in 1993, so almost 30 years ago. And then when I decided to stay on in Boston and in the United States for that matter, I'm a French product. I am an MD and my PhD is in immunology, even though it branched out into vascular biology and, in fact, inflammation in general. After this 2 years of postdoctoral fellowship, I did a I applied for a grant that was like the luck of the naive. And we had already, I mean, the work that I was doing as a postdoctoral fellow seemed very interesting. We had discovered the role of this gene called A20 and its ability to block inflammation by blocking NF-kappa-B activation. Since then, the story has evolved to show the multiple facets of this gene and how it impacts many signaling pathways and, as a result, many disease processes, inflammation being the center of what it does. So it really hits at the center of inflammation. And from there on, again, the luck of the naive, I wrote my first R01 grant just out of postdoctoral fellowship. It was almost by necessity that I went for that because my mentor had, was informed that his funding that was mostly coming from industry was going to dry up. And the decision was made that I will try to write a grant. I went straight for R01, which is not what usually you would do now. You would go more for the other type of K awards, et cetera, with being mentored, which is probably an easier path. But I didn't have this option. And luckily enough, this R01 was funded in addition to another multi-PI grant that we had written with a collaborator at Joslin about islet transplantation. But I did also that same year a clinical fellowship. So it was a bit crazy for me. I wanted to be able to still be able to see patients and to have my medical license in the US. So it was a crazy year for me. And then from there on, things have moved steadily from instructor to assistant professor to associate professor, and then finally to full professor along the line. I mean, as you all know, this requires continued funding and also the scholarship that goes with it. So I was lucky enough to,
So you must have had extraordinary guidance and mentorship of your own. So as you progress through this the faculty ranks, I have to imagine, and please give me some thoughts on this, that you had mentoring along the way, that somewhere
Right.
someone
So
was helping
I,
you and guiding you. And have
yes.
you transitioned that teaching and what you learned now to your own trainings?
Right. So I still remember the first R01 that I wrote, and I definitely want to thank, I had two extraordinary mentors while growing through the system in here. First of all, Dr. Fritz Bach was my primary mentor and remained up until the end. And I still recall when I wrote my first R01. The system also was helpful in that regard because I do remember that Harvard, even though Catalyst was not as big, had a session to how to write your first R01. And we were given, and Dr. Auchincloss, who's now at this point at the NIH, who used to be a transplant surgeon and the chief of transplant surgery at the Mass General Hospital, was handing his grant that was not funded. So we had received, as part of the training, someone who was willing to share an unfunded grant with the comments that went with it, and someone who was willing to share a funded grant with the comments that went with it. But we went with that, but I still recall also at the end, Dr. Bach sitting next to me and helping me edit the grant. For me, there was not only the barrier of not having done that at all, never, except reading Hughes Auchincloss's grant, and I don't recall the other grant that was the funded one, but I guess you most remember the one that was not funded, because they were willing to share that, and it was interesting to see what were the comments of the reviewers. So I think it's really important that the young generation gets exposed to how to write grants and how to understand the comments and to see whatever is going on. But I recall at the end that Dr. Bach was sitting next to me. So again, to go back to my barriers, like language was also to some extent a barrier. I'm French speaking and Arabic speaking initially. So adding English, I mean, you know, English is not my second, is my third language, if not eventually the fourth, because I do speak Spanish also to some extent. And Dr. Bach sitting next to me and editing some of that as well, so that the grant was, you know, so I really, you know, acknowledged the help and the vision that I had and the trust in me that was important, because mentorship is not only about positive and constructive criticism, but it's about people believing in you and helping you develop into the independent investigator that you would like to have. And then my second mentor in this institution is Dr. Frank Lojerfo, who was a chief of vascular surgery. And we met when I was doing my clinical fellowship on the bedside of a patient. And then our relationship still perdures up until now. We are on a couple of multi-PI grants together, and including one that is the longest funded T32 training grant in vascular surgery. That I'm very proud to be multi-PI of, that now we're moving from year 30 to year 35, that is also associated with the T35. So these, Dr. Lojerfo taught me, you know, how to be a mentor. In fact, he is the penultimate mentor. So I learned from both of them different things, but, you know, unfortunately, Dr. Bach passed away, but Dr. Lojerfo is still here, and I still am proud to count him among not only my mentors, but my colleagues and my co.
I can speak to Dr. Bach. He was a mentor. I consider him a mentor of mine. And what you bring up is an interesting point that I've come across in some of the conversations I've had with people like yourself, which is it doesn't normally seem to be that one mentor suits all the bills. So you need to have a multi-mentor approach or a team approach to really achieve your goals. And if you could take me real quickly, how you progress through the ranks. So for instance, who impacted your ability to be promoted to from instructor to assistant and so forth? Was that all through Frank Lojerfo, or was that someone else that it was involved? And that had to be supported by the department chairs and things like that as well.
Yeah, so this needed to be supported by the department chairs. I think that the initial steps at that point, you know, up to the point where I was associate professor, which went on very quickly. Again, it's a bit the luck of the naive, I guess, at that point for me, because I didn't know the system. And for me, in order for me to be able to stay within the same field, I mean, I could have left elsewhere and gone to another postdoctoral fellowship, but if I still wanted to work on this gene that we discovered as being in, you know, the most potent physiologic inhibitor of NF-kappa B, I needed to have my own funding and to stay here within this context. So again, the luck of the naive is that I got this funding. So up until I was promoted to associate professor, Dr. Bach is the person who each time, you know, tell me it's about time for you to be promoted. You have what it takes to be promoted. And it went faster from instructor to associate professor. I think it went in the spans of 5 to 6 years. It took longer to become a full professor. And then you definitely need to have the support of the leadership. So the leadership, you know, at the level of full professor leadership, the chair of the department, Dr. Fisher at that point, was the one who proposed my name to be promoted. And I think there is now in the Department of Surgery a system where everybody, there is a promotion committee that is not only there to check whether you are you know, eligible for promotion, but it's always is also there to help you, you know, achieve what is required for you to get the next promotion. So at that time, Dr. P.O. Hasselgren was the equivalent of our chief academic officer for the Department of Surgery, or the chair of research. And the two of them, Dr. Fisher and Dr. Hasselgren, together with both Dr. Bach and Dr. Lojervo at that time, pushed for the promotion to associate professor back in 2008.
It is a team effort. I'm convinced of it. So if you were now to switch gears on the conversation and now turn it to your trainees, your postdocs, your physician scientists, you know, are you training them? Are you finding yourself training them primarily for academia? Are they coming in and expected to go into private practice for those who are clinical versus industry for that matter? Are you?
Yeah.
What is your approach to
that's a very academic good. Thanks, Leo, for this question, because I was reviewing, we just were in the process of renewing our T32 grants, and I was reviewing the number of trainees that came through my lab now in the 30 years that I've been here, and it's over 110. Wow. And that goes from undergraduate students, which we like to have and like to incentivize them to take on these kinds but these kinds of profession. It's very demanding, whether you decide to go into medicine or to decide to go into science and to embrace it fully. And you know, I'm a big proponent of academia. So most of the people that I train, and I do train physicians. So again, they go from undergrads to medical school students to graduate students, and a big number of both residents and postdoctoral fellows. I have even trained, I train junior faculty, but also some of our senior faculty. And that includes Dr. Ajit Thomas, who is now the chief of neurosurgery at Cooper, who was already associate professor and an amazing neurovascular surgeon, but who had this angst to do research for which he wasn't necessarily trained or had not received a proper training, but had ideas, and he was absolutely brilliant. And I hosted him together with his postdoc in my lab for some time. So the training, like I try to keep as many of them as I can in academia by showing them what is important. And I mean, I still believe up until now, even if industry is very attractive and the money is industry and very attractive and the creativity is in industry has changed over the past 30 years, but you do not have in industry the freedom that right. you have in, and you and I know, I mean, because we started with xenotransplantation and moved all along. I mean, what we do is gene therapy. What I do in my lab, given that this gene needs to go into the cell, it's an intracytoplasmic, it's all sorts of gene therapies. And I think that any company that would have been sponsoring that 30 years ago would have dropped the project in no time when there were issues with gene therapies, you know,
right.
back in the early days of gene therapies at UPenn. Whereas now there is a second revival, but I was able all along, thanks to NIH funding and different foundations funding, whether the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, the Transplant Foundation, the National Science Foundation, and all of that, to keep the progress going so that right. we have all what it takes now to say, listen, I have all these animal models, I have all these proof of concept, and we have new gene therapy tools. And now I'm talking to several companies dealing with different gene therapy tools in order to take this to the clinic. And this is something that only academia gives you. But the most difficult task that I've had has been, you know, because you said physician scientists, and it's a bit easier to get them to do science. But I've been tasked to train surgeon scientists, where, wow. as you know, surgeons need to be in the operating room, and their protected time is less than others. And I'm very proud to say that we have kept a lot of them in science and in surgery, with now 5 or 6 that have been, I think I have now on the roster of my trainees, five or six who are full professor, a few of them who are chief of divisions, and also 6 or 7 of them who are NIH funded R01s. That's an achievement for surgery.
Oh my gosh, that's an amazing achievement. And I have to ask, what is it that you think is instilling in them this desire to stay and research, because, you know, due to their clinical duties and their time commitments that they have to meet, what is it that you think you instill in them that keeps them interested? And
they have it in them. It's not like I instill in them, but I show them what are the possibilities. I mean, they know that they need to understand. It has always been like that. And in fact, what drove me, I'm a physician, and what drove me into science is when I was as a resident in the intensive care unit, giving patients OKT3, an anti-CD3 antibody to treat rejections. And these patients would go into some sort of septic shock after you give them the first antibody. And I'm like, what is this? And that scared me so much that I went to a formal PhD. And I think all of them understand that they will need to be, they are the recipient of all these new products, whether devices or new products. And if they don't understand that, and they don't, a lot of the surgery residency and the medicine residency training, in fact, the fellowships have an embedded 2 years of research in it, and which is what we have in our department. Right. And that gives them the possibility to realize and to appreciate how important it is for them, even if they decide not to go into research afterwards in their clinical capacity, but at least to understand what right. is it that they are receiving from these different companies. And some of them chose to stay in. It's really important the way things are progressing. Research is multidisciplinary, and you need to have the eye of the surgeon to know what is feasible, what is doable in the OR, within the constraints of the OR. You need to have the perspective of the physician in order to see, and you need to have all sorts of scientists, whether, data science or bench science, molecular science. You need to have them coming together in order to solve a problem.
So that in that vein of those who stay in research, have you found it? I know one of the challenges that principal investigators have with young trainees who are destined to stay in academia, and they're in your lab and they want to start their own lab, or they have visions of starting their own lab. How have you found that it's an easy transition for them to leave a lab which is productive like yours and exciting projects, and then have to take a piece of what you've trained them to do and essentially start anew, right? So many will say you have to go find your own story, your own interests, and develop that on your own. Yours is A20, and others. Do you have a method, or do you have a strategy, or whatever the descriptor would be, to say how do you approach that with someone who comes into your lab?
I understand that, and it is a problem, and it is expected. But to go back to your previous question, some of them now, unfortunately, because how difficult it has become for those who are not clinicians also, whether surgeons or in medicine, a lot of, unfortunately, the scientists, the PhDs, are choosing to go to industry because it's easier and there is more funding and all of the above, precisely, coming to this question that you have, because it's difficult to go independent and to prove that you are independent from your mentor. I'm one that defense, and I have proof for it. I don't know if you recall one of my earlier postdocs, Shane Gray, who is from Australia, Shane, when he came to my lab, was not a diabetes person or an islet person. He was working on different aspects of inflammation and coagulation, but not at all what we're doing, And then this was the funding that I had at this point, and he got trained into that. But then he left the lab and went to Australia to start his own lab. He remained in the same field. And in fact, we had an agreement that he will take the islet transplant part of it, because my lab was doing more related type 1 diabetes project. So this whole idea that the postdocs who leave you need to do something completely different, might be, if that is their interest, this is what they should do, and they should expand. But I think they could take also something of what they learned here and expand it. This is, in fact, I think my biggest achievement. So Shane, as we speak, is now a full professor at Sydney, and then he just struck a deal with a company to genetically engineer islets with A20, which is what we had started here. And they have a specific device where they are putting it, in the in the arm, you know, right. And that is protecting. So that to me is success. Another one of my amazing postdocs who's now in Austria is working on A20 in cancer, which we are not doing in the lab. Right. And another of our surgeons now, breast cancer surgeon, who's now at the Mount Auburn, we're in fact collaborating together on a project of A20 and breast cancer. So all of this just to say, but some of them have chosen to go and have their own labs and their right. own projects that are more, you know, separate some of them have different skills that right. are different than mine.
Right. And I can see how that would be the most successful way to approach this, because they can then still come back to you eventually for mentoring. So do you find that the Shanes and those that have left your lab before or since ever come back to you and say, I've run into a problem of my own, and your mentoring never stops? It's like being a parent almost.
No, it is like being a parent. I mean, I can show you the, you know, yes, Hervik, I keep writing letters. Shane is now full professor. He has his own, you know, he doesn't need me as much anymore, but, like all children, you right. know, but the others still do. And I think I have edited every single almost grant that they have sent from wherever they are all over the country. I mean, our visiting professors for the last 2 years for our T32, for the graduation of our T32 vascular surgery fellows, were V. Patel, who's the chief of vascular surgery now at Columbia, and then now it was Sal Scali, who's a professor now in the Division of Vascular Surgery in Florida with a newly funded R01. You know, I've written letters every single step of their promotions right. and every single step of their lives. I'm happy editing their grants. Hervik sends me, you know, feedback. So I'm sometimes on their papers as well.
Right. So it's continued. Input,
no,
and
yes,
advice,
and
guidance,
yes,
and
this is
end.
Continued advice, but this is what we like doing. I mean, our success is not only what we have built at the scientific level or in our medical practice. Our success is how we have, you know, mentored
legacy almost,
and the success of our mentees is even more so important than our success.
So if you had to look back on your trajectory and how you progressed to where you are today, and you were to give advice to someone like we've just discussed, having made mistakes, you know, what was the mistake that you would, maybe you had none, that you would
no,
like
no,
to go back
I,
and say,
I have
I wish,
made mistakes.
I wish I had done this differently. And what would that look like? Well, give me one
yes.
example or two examples.
The one mistake, I don't know if it was a mistake, but I didn't have much choice in that regard. I think the one mistake that I have made, it has pluses. I'm not saying that it doesn't have pluses, but it has cons as well. It is expected, and it is usually better if you move. And even if you have to come back to what you considered as being your alma mater, right? I mean, for me, BITMC is home. I've been here for 30 years. I've trained here clinically, and I've trained here as a fellow in research as well. So this is home. And I had the opportunity of moving, but for different circumstances, different reasons, I didn't move. I think moving and being surrounded with other type of peoples and other type of culture, if you want, it could have been something that I would have liked to do. So I'd really try to push my trainees to, because a lot of them would like to stay. And obviously they will be like kind of their lab is sitting next to yours, which is what they have been used to. And they kind of grew with it. And it's easier to knock on your door rather than to send you an email or a text or to call you. That's right. But I try to push them to move out and to see what is out there, and some of them I really am pushing now and helping go also to industry, because industry again and the new system in biotechs that still have a lot of innovation and a lot of creativity and you know in it at this point, although not as much freedom, I have to be honest with that, you know, probably is much more attractive nowadays for a lot of the trainees as well. So I try to have them explore more. I think I should have explored more as well. But again, we're very spoiled in this environment, because you know, people who explore, they want to go to an environment. And one of your questions, you know, what is it that you choose? You choose the mentor or you choose the environment? Well, both are important. But here we're so lucky that even if you're in your direct environment, you don't have the people with whom you know you need to work or you want to collaborate or else, you know, you just need to cross the street. So we are in a microcosm that is so rich that the need to move might not be as urgent. But even if you move just across the street, you know, it's different. It's a different culture, and you will gain from having different visions and maybe sure. encountering other type of mentors and other systems of doing things.
I think you're 100% right, and I think that's what. Although I think there's goods and bads to both versions, staying versus going, you know, the challenges of starting a new lab and a new environment is fraught with challenges that you may not have foreseen, and you're comfortable where you are. But I do think you get different perspectives. But that speaks to also as a level of mentoring, that even in the same environment, you also reach out to those from other institutions, right? Like you've done, you've elaborated so many different aspects to what you've done and accomplished with interactions and across the affiliates and industry. Obviously, you've worked with the HMS and the Blavatnik, so you've touched on many things. So it's still doable by staying where you are in an environment that we find ourselves in, because it is such a lucrative candy jar, if you will, of opportunity.
It is a candy jar. It's just absolutely fantastic. No, every day when I think about it, you know, now I work with Orna Therapeutics, and the founder was just coming out of his PhD, and now I find myself mentoring him, Alex, and helping him. So it's really interesting, you know, to know that we are in a microcosm that is non-comparable. I'm sure that there are many other pockets in, and I review now for the NIH for the small businesses study sections, so I can see the different other sure. pockets where you know, bio industries are progressing and biotech is there. But I don't think that any of those compares to whatever we have here.
No, I agree. Area. I couldn't agree. I mean, the opportunities here, and I like to try myself to encourage those to get out and to go to different seminars and take advantage of what's offered across Longwood Medical Area. You know, you've described, and I've appreciated your time. You're a true success story. But I have to ask you at the as we end this, you know, with all the things you've described and your history and your current activities, how do you manage your time? How do you do all this? Because you have a family, you have a loving husband, you obviously have a work-life balance that you like to manage. So how do you, if you were to give somebody who's overwhelmed, feeling overwhelmed at their stage where they're trying to get grants and they're trying to do their experiments, I have people that say to me, I don't know how I can write grants and do experiments at the same time. And my wife is telling me, why am I late? And my daughter or my son is not seeing me as often. And I have one who is actually having to travel to different countries to see their family. How, in your experience, coming from the background that you have described, how do you manage it?
Challenging, Leo. That's the only question where I think it's really kind of challenging. And I know that as far as I'm concerned, I mean, it's really important that you are in a relationship with someone who understands that this is not a job, this is a profession, and there is a drive, and it's really important. And it's also important to know to remove the guilt. Like, I used to feel guilty because I would be the only mom who would not, like, my son would be the last one to be picked up from school, from after school programs, or you know, and from daycare or whatever. But then now that he is older and he is in college, I think he appreciates everything that I'm doing in a different manner. So this sentiment of guilt, I think children, you know, understand probably better than spouses, let's put it this way, understand the need for doing these kind of things if you explain to them what is it that you're doing and what is it that you're trying to achieve. Obviously, family always comes first, and sometimes in some circumstances when there are emergencies, but you know, you need to be, you're not someone who's going to be a 9-to-5 kind of person. Right. This is the kind of life that you want, you're not in the right business. And it's important. So one of the things that I do in terms of mentoring is trying to make sure that they understand what's the commitment at this point. The commitment is extremely difficult. And of course, you take more. But again, I have training in residency and all of that. So I'm used not to sleep much. So that's not a problem for me. And people don't even see it because I'm used to that. But not to say that this is great. But I think it is important to know that it's not a commitment, and your family, your spouse, and your kids need to be embracing that as well. And it is absolutely doable. And the one advice that also when I reflect on the mistake that I make, I think sometimes we don't know how to say no. And this is what I'm trying to teach myself first before teaching my mentees. We need to choose that our priorities in life, family is one of them, you know, what we're doing is another one. But then there are all the other, how should I put it, noise that comes with it. And sometimes the noise you have to do because this is part of your job description and this is, you know, but sometimes the noise could be reduced and it's not a major problem to say no. That has been, you know, one of my default, but I don't know if this is generalizable, but talking to some of my colleagues, I know that they have sometimes some, you know, problems saying no. So I think what I'm trying to teach my mentees is that they need to make sure that their priorities are straight. But again, if their vision of life is having a less, you know, our time is difficult to, you know, when it's grant time and many other chores that we have to deal with, you know, there is no other way but giving it the time that it needs there, right. You know, and if you're not, then this is not the life for you. There are many other jobs that are, you know, but you need to be excited. I mean, right. I know that every day when I come to the lab and when I talk to my trainees and when I'm meeting with this and meeting with collaborators, I am excited every single
I can attest to that, Dr. Farhan, for sure.
No, I am excited at every single step of the way. So it is a choice because some people ask me, how come you're not making so much more money in industry? And that would have been a choice as well. And I know in the back of my mind, it's good for me to know that there is this one choice and there is a choice of just going and treating patients. And I think I'm a good doctor and I could treat patients and I have my license here or just doing that, you know.
Right, right.
But what I love doing is this, what I'm doing now and that what you are doing, which is hopefully coming up with new treatments, you know.
I think staying in the patients. Showing that excitement is certainly an asset to mentoring, because I think it instills motivation and enthusiasm in those you're talking with. So this has been a wonderful conversation. I appreciate
Thank
your
you
time
so much.
Today. And I'm here with Christian Farhan, and it's been a wonderful experience. And I thank you for your time. And we'll be seeing each other for lunch soon, I'm sure.
Thank you, Leo. And thank you for doing all this for our mentees. And I'm sure they all appreciate it. Very much so. And they all know that, you know, my email, I mostly respond to email if anybody needs to ask any question.
You're definitely one I would turn them to. Thank you again. I'm going to stop recording.